And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, death row inmates could have a chance at a new sentence, thanks to an Oregon Supreme Court ruling. Rural officials publicly reject the statewide vaccine mandate, and Senate Republicans agree to raise the debt ceiling until December. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 8th, 2021. KBOO is currently in the final stretch of our fall fund drive, and we'd like to encourage you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman. Death row inmates could get another look at their sentences thanks to a new ruling from the Oregon Supreme Court. The case rejects a death sentence for one defendant who was convicted before the legislature restricted who a death penalty could apply to. Legal experts say it could have wider implications for other people on death row. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
The Oregon Supreme Court just overturned a death sentence in a landmark ruling that almost certainly applies to 23 others on death row in the state. The court ruling centers on a case involving David Bartle, a member of a white supremacist gang who was convicted of aggravated murder for a jailhouse killing in 2013. Bartle murdered another inmate in the Marion County Jail in what was described as an unprovoked attack. Bartle was sentenced to death. The Oregon Supreme Court upheld his conviction, but not his sentence. It ruled that his crime did not meet the definition of aggravated murder under the 2019 law restricting the types of crime eligible for the death penalty. That's Senate Bill 1013. Only the crime of aggravated murder can get a possible death sentence in Oregon. It applies to people who have killed two or more persons in an act of organized terrorism, killed a child younger than 14 in a premeditated act, killed a person while locked up in jail or prison for a previous murder, or killed a police corrections or probation officer in a premeditated way. Bartle was already being held on attempted aggravated murder charges at the time he committed the Marion County Jail murder. 2 years ago, the Oregon legislature said Senate Bill 1013 does not apply retroactively. But the Supreme Court has now decided that passing that bill in the legislature implies a decision about which crimes deserve the most severe punishment, regardless of when they were committed. The court ruling said sentencing Bartle to death would allow the execution of a person for conduct the legislature has said no longer justifies that unique and ultimate punishment. Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum said she thought the court decision was thoughtful and promised to work diligently to implement the ruling in all affected cases. However, her office did not respond to an email asking how many other cases are affected by the ruling. No other state has executed a person for a crime reclassified by its legislature. Jeff Ellis is a defense lawyer specializing in capital cases. Ellis believes the Bartle ruling will have broad implications and that every existing death sentence in the state should be overturned. He predicts all death row defendants will look to be resentenced. Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. He says Oregon's ruling mirrors one happening in Connecticut. The Connecticut legislature abolished the death penalty in 2012, and the state Supreme Court applied its ruling retroactively 3 years later, using a similar evolving standards of decency theory. 27 states, including Oregon, have an existing death penalty. 3 of them have a moratorium on applying it. Prosecutors say the Oregon Supreme Court decision undermines decisions handed down in previous murder trials. Wayne County District Attorney Paige Clarkson said that Bartle is likely only the first beneficiary in a chain reaction of new sentences for the most horrific of crimes by the most dangerous of offenders. She added the prospect of new sentence hearings will reopen old wounds for the victim's loved ones. The last person put to death in Oregon was Henry Charles Moore, who was executed in 1997. Governor Kate Brown has continued a moratorium on executions put into place in 2011 by her predecessor, Governor John Kitzhaber. The implication of the recent Supreme Court ruling is that State Bill 1013 sets new expectations for what deserves a death penalty, and that no one should be executed who does not meet the updated standards. Experts believe the decision cannot be appealed to the federal or United States Supreme Courts because justices made it clear they were deciding their case based on, quote, state grounds, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The deadline is fast approaching for Governor Brown's mandate for public sector and healthcare workers to get their vaccines. Workers in these fields must be vaccinated against COVID-19 by October 18th or risk losing their jobs. It applies to executive branch employees, healthcare workers, and K-12 educators and volunteers. The mandate has pushed many to finally get their vaccine since it was created after the FDA fully approved the Pfizer vaccine. But some local officials are not happy with statewide mandates intended to curb the spread of the pandemic. Josephine County Commissioner Darren Fowler is under fire for remarks he made at a public meeting on Wednesday. Here's an excerpt of what Fowler said about whether people should get a vaccine.
You're just going to have to ask God and pray for wisdom on this one, because you can't trust the politicians. You can't trust the doctors. You certainly can't trust the CDC or any World Health Organization. And I can only think that it's because you're down to the Republicans. And if you could purge all of our systems of Republicans, get them to leave the state, then I bet you would. I bet you would in a heartbeat. And I think that's a lot of what's behind the governor's agenda right now, is let's cleanse Oregon of all the red and get as blue as we can.
Josephine County, where Fowler is a commissioner, is one of the counties where COVID-19 has hit hardest in the Delta wave. Only 53% of adults in the county are vaccinated, compared to an average of 70% statewide. Earlier in the summer, YouTube removed a video of a regular commission meeting for Josephine County for allegedly spreading misinformation. The coming vaccination deadline raises concerns that Southern Oregon hospitals will lose workers while they are already short-staffed. Estacada Mayor Sean Drinkwine also said in a public meeting that he doesn't support mask and vaccine mandates. Drinkwine then clarified that these were personal opinions, not those of the city. An Oregon Court of Appeals judge refused to put a temporary pause on the vaccination mandate for 33 state troopers who sued in Jefferson County. 8 lawsuits have been filed against the governor's order so far. The judge in the Jefferson County case wrote, quote, "The police power of the state includes the authority to enact public health laws that may have the effect of curtailing individual rights," end quote. In another lawsuit against the mandate, a judge similarly did not pause the mandate but wrote the challenges to it by workers opposed to vaccination have, quote, "little to no likelihood of success," end quote. Communities of color want to ensure that they receive proper representation in the new voting maps Washington State draws with 2020 census data. People of color make up 1/3 of the state's population, but only represent a majority in 2% of state legislative districts. Eric Tegedoff has more.
As the Washington State Redistricting Commission considers drawing new lines for voting districts, a coalition of groups is urging greater representation for people of color. Kamal Shege is head of the Washington Community Alliance, which is part of the coalition Redistricting Justice for Washington. Shege notes people of color make up about 1/3 of the state's population. However, as the maps are currently drawn, they're the majority in only one of the state's 10 congressional districts and only 2% of state legislative districts.
They really amplify the power of the white electorate much more than what is proportional to their population, and they really disempower voters of color and communities of color.
The Washington State Redistricting Commission held a public meeting this week with 4 proposed maps for state legislative districts. It holds a public meeting on its 4 proposed congressional district maps on Saturday. The public can submit comments while the commission makes its decisions. The Redistricting Justice for Washington Coalition has proposed 1 congressional map and 5 state legislative maps. Shege says a major focus of the coalition is Yakima County, where a district line cuts through the Yakima Reservation,
which in 2010 was split between the 14th and the 15th legislative district, which meant that the power of their votes were diluted since they're not able to vote in concert and organize with the rest of the Yakima Nation.
The coalition says the previous district map in 2010 also divided and diluted Latino voters in Yakima County. Shege says the U.S. system for redistricting is different from many other countries.
Most industrialized countries have a system of proportional representation, where if you're 30% of the population, you're able to win 30% of the seats. And that's something that everybody understands.
The commission's deadline to release its final map is November 15th. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The elite Catlin Gable School in Portland fired an educator accused of sexual abuse this time last year. Decades of allegations of sexual misconduct have been reported at Catlin Gable since early 2020. So far, there are 27 people with abuse claims. Many of those accused died before any justice could be created, but this most recent accusation may be different. Middle school librarian Lynn Silbernagel was fired last September after the school learned of a sexual abuse filing from a student 24 years earlier. The student alleges being groomed and sexually abused by Silbernagel while in eighth grade in 1997. The victims of alleged abuse are seeking now $80 million in damages from the school. September in Oregon was unusually warm and wet, and Portland stood out as one of the wettest locations, according to a new report. KBOO's Aurora Biggers has more with Climate Central meteorologist Sean Sublett.
A recent Climate Matters bulletin produced by Climate Central shows Portland's weather last month was much warmer and wetter than normal. We have Climate Central meteorologist Sean Sublett with us to talk about this unusual weather. Welcome on, Sean.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Of course. Sean, this report shows that Portland's September average temperature of 67 degrees Fahrenheit was 1.3 degrees above the normal, and the precipitation, the rain, was 241% of the normal amount of rain. That's a lot of data. Can you tell us what this data means and why we had such unusual weather last month?
Yes, this is indicative of what we're seeing in a lot of places across the world as the climate continues to warm. A lot of places are having routinely some of their hottest summers on record, not every single summer, but more often than not, the summers are hotter than average, and sometimes they are upwards of the hottest on record. And wetter climates are tending to get a little bit wetter. Drier climates are tending to get a little bit drier. So this is kind of something that we're seeing on a global scale finally coming home, if you will, into Oregon.
Yeah, that actually leads us into our next question, which is about climate change. It seems like Septembers in Portland are historically getting hotter based on your data. It shows that Septembers in Portland have been slowly getting hotter since even 1970. Does that mean Portlanders should expect to see our late summer and early fall weather continue to get hotter each year in the future?
Yeah, it won't be hotter every subsequent year. There are still going to be up and downs for sure. But as you look through these 5 and 10 and 15 year averages, those numbers are going to be going up. So you're not going to have as many of these relatively cool Septembers like we had in the 70s and even in the 80s. Those kinds of coolish Septembers are going to be waning. So you're going to have maybe not searing heat every September, but you're going to have fewer and fewer of these kind of cool Septembers that we had 30 to 40 years ago.
I know this data was focused on Portland's weather patterns over the summer, and particularly this last month in September, but the heat waves that we saw over the summer were not just centralized to Portland. We saw them all over the state, and I think that's what you're saying. So what exactly makes Portland unique in the way that it will experience the heat as opposed to more rural or outside of the metropolitan areas of Oregon?
Yeah, the heat was really big in lots of places westward from the Front Range of the Rockies. But it was also very hot, again, relative to normal or the long-term average, farther eastward toward the northern plains, the Great Lakes, and even parts of the Northeast. In fact, the only place that this past summer that wasn't hot compared to normal heat was in the Southeast because it was a little bit wetter there and a little cloudier as a result, and that's what helped keep the temperatures down there. But one of the things that we do see physically is that in the core of urban centers where there's still a lot of pavement and concrete, those tend to be even hotter than the outside countryside, 20 or 30 miles away from the city. So they tend to keep the heat in place a little bit more. They're called urban heat islands. So anything that a city can do to decrease that effect, you know, more parks, more trees within the city, more green space within the city, that will help a little bit with the temperatures during the hottest part of the summer. But yeah, it's hard to be ready for temperatures that are 110 to 115 degrees if you've never had them before.
If you're just now listening, we've been talking with Climate Central meteorologist Sean Sublett about Portland's unusually hot and wet weather last month. Sean, if our listeners have further questions about these weather changes, where can they access more information?
Yeah, there are several good locations. You can go to our portal on the web at climatecentral.org, but there are several other excellent places to get climate information. And one of my favorites is actually from NASA. They have an excellent climate change page. It's very simple, climate.nasa.gov.
That was Sean Sublett, meteorologist for Climate Central. And for KBOO Radio, I'm Aurora Biggers.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Today, host Janine Jackson will be discussing efforts to save the U.S. Postal Service and anti-racism education under attack across the country. At 6, it's KBOO's Hispanic and Latinx Heritage Month series. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 46. Tomorrow, the clouds will continue with some sun peeking through and a high of 65 degrees. Today in history, in 1956, the New York Yankees' Don Larsen pitched the only perfect game ever in a World Series. The quote of the day is from American novelist R.L. Stein, sometimes referred to as the Stephen King of children's literature. Stein said, quote, "I always just wanted to be funny. I never really planned to be scary," end quote. America's former envoy to Haiti learned about mass deportations of Haitians in Texas on the news, and the Senate punts on the debt ceiling debate until December. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I think it's horrible. It's unconscionable. It's going to be a stain on this administration.
California Democrat Juan Vargas called the rapid deportation of thousands of Haitians in Del Rio, Texas, a terrible overreaction by the Biden administration. During a congressional briefing Thursday, Vargas heard from former envoy Daniel Foote, who resigned over the use of a public health order to expel Haitian refugees. Foote says he found out about the deportations on the news.
I thought, you know, I'm the special envoy, so maybe when we're making policy decisions, someone comes to me and says, is this good? Is this bad? But it didn't happen.
Roughly 7,000 migrants who fled political turmoil were sent back to Haiti in recent weeks, which Foote says is not the answer.
Deportation in the short term is not going to make Haiti more stable. In fact, it's going to make it worse.
Foote argued diplomatic solutions are needed in Haiti to stem migration to U.S. borders. Late yesterday, the Senate agreed to a short-term two-month increase in the debt ceiling, raising it by $480 billion until December 2nd. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi indicated she would cut the chamber's recess short next week to vote on the bill. The White House said President Joe Biden will sign it. Meanwhile, discussions continue over Biden's Build Back Better agenda amid divisions among Democrats over the price and scope of the package. Minnesota Democrat Senator Tina Smith's among those demanding the plan address the climate crisis.
It is required. To include strong climate legislation, legislation that gets us where we have to go to protect our globe.
Supporters contend provisions in the proposed $3.5 trillion plan can cut U.S. pollution nearly 45% in the next 10 years. Two leaders of the Stop the Steal group were subpoenaed by the House committee investigating the January 6th attack. Ali Alexander and Nathan Martin are expected to testify about the rally they planned prior to the Capitol breach. Alexander has claimed he contacted Republican Congressman Mo Brooks, Paul Gozer, and Andy Biggs about the event. Biggs is the only one who has commented on the claim and denies it. Biggs also made headlines for his answer when Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin asked Thursday if the Arizona election audit showed Joe Biden won and received more votes than former President Donald Trump.
We don't know, because the audit demonstrates very clearly, Mr. Raskin, there are a lot of issues with this election that took place.
The vice chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Elections testified the election was fair and accurate and accused some Republicans of choosing party over truth.
They have attacked the work that was done by our elections workers in Maricopa County, and they have fanned the flames of conspiracy. And this willingness to do so, unfortunately, is what led to the first non-peaceful transfer of power in our country's history.
A report on the six-month audit confirmed November's results. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Biden administration is restoring environmental protections to 3 national monuments, including Bear's Ears in Utah. And a report claims the Indian Health Service willfully ignored sexual abuse of children by a doctor working for the agency. With those stories and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. President Biden announced Thursday he is restoring environmental protections to 3 national monuments that were removed by the Trump administration. Grand Staircase Escalante and Bears Ears National Monuments are in Utah. Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Monument is off the coast of New England. The New York Times reports the reduction of Bears Ears by nearly 85% in 2017 sparked an outcry by Native Americans as well as environmentalists and paleontologists. It was established in 2016 by President Barack Obama after years of negotiations, input, and advocacy on behalf of tribes, NGOs, and the public. The Native American Rights Fund said the Hopi Tribe, Navajo Nation, Pueblo of Zuni, Ute Indian Tribe, and Ute Mountain Indian Tribe led the effort to establish Bears Ears National Monument. It applauded the move by the Biden-Harris administration. Rights Fund staff attorney Matthew Campbell said the proclamation will, quote, roll back unpopular and illegal efforts to rip away needed protections for these ancestral lands and cultural resources. He said the group looks forward to seeing the sacred landscape properly protected and, quote, we look forward to seeing that it happens in a culturally appropriate way. The administration said in a press release it's committed to ensuring adequate staffing and resources for the area and to make Bears Ears a model for tribal participation in the management of the monument. A new report on the Indian Health Service reveals the agency willfully ignored sexual abuse by a doctor working for the service. The New York Times reports IHS commissioned the report, which found members of the agency also silenced and punished whistleblowers who sought to bring allegations against Stanley Patrick Weber to its attention. It concludes leaders in the agency ignored the complaints because addressing them would be, quote, awkward, arduous, inconvenient, messy, and embarrassing. Weber worked as a pediatrician with IHS and preyed upon Native boys for decades in Montana and South Dakota. He was convicted in 2019 and is serving multiple life sentences. The report was written early last year, but kept under wraps until now. It was finally made public through a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit brought by the Times and the Wall Street Journal. The report recommends IHS install whistleblower protection coordinators around the country and create an internal system to track allegations. A spokeswoman for the agency said it has started making changes, including a hotline to report child and sexual abuse, training for all employees and contractors in handling reports of abuse, and implementing stronger patient safety protocols. Timothy Davis, chairman of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, where some of the abuse occurred, said his community wants an apology from IHS and accountability for those who hid the abuse. Davis told the Times, "To allow this pediatrician to do this to our children for all these years is unforgivable and atrocious." A state natural resources policy board in Wisconsin took no action Friday during a special closed-door session on lawsuits over a planned wolf hunt. The Journal Times reports 6 Ojibwe tribes sued the board to stop the fall hunt. They said the Department of Natural Resources is ignoring sound biological principles and mismanaging natural resources in violation of treaties signed in the 19th century. Another lawsuit by conservation groups also seeks to stop the hunt and void a 2011 law that mandates a hunt when wolves are not on the endangered species list. The Trump administration removed the gray wolf from the list. Wisconsin Public Radio reported that earlier this this week, the Department of Natural Resources set a quota of 130 wolves for the fall hunt, far lower than the 300 the policy-setting board wanted. Hunters and trappers will be able to take 74 wolves, and the remaining wolves will be awarded to the Ojibwe tribes, who have traditionally chosen to protect their share. The hunt is slated to start on November 6th. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Environmental groups say lead pipe replacement, especially in marginalized communities, is incredibly urgent. Flint, Michigan made national news for its lead pipe water crisis and still hasn't gotten its water supply fixed. Lead pipes leaching into the water supply are impacting another town in Michigan, Benton Harbor. It's a majority black community, and it's faced lead levels far higher than the national threshold for pipe replacement for 3 years straight. Lily Bolke has the story.
As Congress continues to negotiate infrastructure and social safety net bills, advocates for environmental justice say measures like lead pipe replacement can't wait. Drinking water systems for more than 9 million homes across the country contain lead pipes, with black, brown, and low-income communities disproportionately affected. Mustafa Santiago Ali, who works on environmental and climate justice issues for the National Wildlife Federation, says removing lead pipes will benefit children's health and educational outcomes, since exposure to lead is linked to kids' difficulties learning and reading.
It then also helps to raise values inside of communities, property values, because we know there's a huge wealth gap that exists between black and brown communities and white communities. So there's so many different positives that can happen.
Last month, environmental groups filed an emergency petition with the EPA to get a free and safe drinking water supply to Benton Harbor, a majority black community in southwestern Michigan. The city has reported extremely high lead levels in the local water for 3 years. Ali notes the federal threshold for taking action is when lead is detected at a level above 15 parts per billion. In Benton Harbor, some water in homes has tested more than 800 parts per billion. He says this water crisis, like what happened in Flint, is an example of disinvestment in a community.
Well, we have sacrifice zones across our country where people have made decisions to disinvest in certain areas. And many times those areas are black and brown communities and indigenous communities. They're lower wealth white communities sometimes. So we have a chance to change that dynamic.
More than 60% of Americans in recent polls say they support the trillion-dollar legislation now in Congress to improve roads, bridges, broadband, and other infrastructure, including funding for lead pipe replacement. This is Lily Bolke with Michigan News Connection.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 8th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Aurora Biggers. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, Lily Bolke, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Megan Kamerick. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings.